So when I first went to India looking for a teacher, it was almost 50 years ago, in 1967. And I went around in northern India looking, going to different ashrams, looking for some teacher that I could resonate with. And I finally ended up in Bodh Gaya, the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. And at that time, there were just maybe five or six Westerners there. It was quite different than it is now. Very small village, not much happening. And my first teacher, Munindraji, had just come back from 9 years in Burma, where he had been practicing and studying. At the first meeting, my first meeting with Munindraji, he said something which was so practical and so down to earth that I just resonated completely. I knew that I had found what I was looking for. So what he said at that first meeting was, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. It was that simple. There was nothing to join. There was no big ceremony or ritual. If you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. Or stand up and observe it. Or walk and observe it. It basically comes from being mindful of our own minds. That's the way we can come to understand ourselves. And it just seemed like such common sense. How else can we understand ourselves except by observing what it is that's going on? Of course, as he also said, what is very simple is not always easy. And this was a phrase he used a lot, simple but not easy. And you probably have some taste of that already. So we can begin this exploration of our minds by directing our attention to one of the most important aspects of it, and an aspect which the Buddha highlighted in the second step of the Eightfold Noble Path. That is, by paying attention to the thoughts that are arising in our minds. And it's amazing how many thoughts keep coming. You know, in the course of a day, probably thousands. And of course, our minds are conditioned by the kinds of thoughts we have. So this is a teaching from the Buddha, which it's one of my favorite ones because the truth of it is so obvious, but we don't often apply the understanding of it in our lives. So he said bhikkhus. And usually bhikkhus is translated as monks. But as Bhikkhu Bodhi, you know, one of the great translators of our times, he said that in its more general meaning, the term bhikkhu refers to anyone who is walking on this path. So really when the Buddha says bhikkhus, he's addressing all of us, you know, and so we should hear it in that way. He said, bhikkhus, whatever one frequently thinks about and ponders upon, that is, reflects about, that will become the inclination of the mind. Whatever one frequently thinks about and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. So this points to the very obvious but often overlooked truth of the great power of habit in our lives. Habit is a tremendously powerful force that conditions what we do. The more often a particular thought arises, or the more often a particular pattern of thoughts arise in the mind, the more likely it is that that same thought and that same pattern will arise again. It's as if we're deepening the neural pathways in the brain with every repetitive thought that we have. So if we understand this, that it's not simply a passing phenomena, although a thought is that as well, but if we're not mindful of it, it is actually conditioning future thoughts arising. And so we get caught in these habit patterns. When we understand the power of thought in this way, we can understand why the Buddha gave it such importance. You know, he made it the second step of the Eightfold Path, right thought. So we need to come to an understanding of that. So given that our actions, what we do in the world, are conditioned by the thoughts we have, our actions are preceded by thoughts, and that wholesome and unwholesome actions bring about their respective results. I mean, this is the law of karma. Unwholesome actions, rooted in greed or hatred or delusion, will bring about some kind of suffering in our lives, suffering in our own minds, and thoughts rooted in non-greed or generosity, love, wisdom, will bring about happiness. And we can see that in our own minds. So when we understand how all this is working, we can see the essential importance for our own happiness and the happiness of others that we cultivate those thoughts and those actions which bring about, which will result in peace, in happiness, in well-being. That we learn to cultivate those kinds of thoughts and abandon the thoughts which lead to suffering. So in some way, it's very simple, but it's not easy, because the habit patterns are very deeply entrenched. You know, and mostly people are living out their lives just acting out the various kinds of conditioning. Because without mindfulness of thought, without being mindful of what's arising in our hearts and in our minds, we really don't have choice. We're just playing out the conditioning. And it's precisely because of this that the cultivation of mindfulness of our thought, mindfulness of our intentions, is absolutely essential if we want to experience some taste of freedom. So as with so many different aspects of the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha was very specific about what he called right thought. He didn't just leave it as a kind of general notion that we should try to figure out for ourselves. He said, and what, bhikkhus, is right thought? So he's going to give us the answer. He said, it is thoughts and resolve of renunciation, free of sensual desire. Thoughts of goodwill, of metta, free of ill will. Thoughts of compassion, free of cruelty. So this is the general framework. Right thought, our thoughts of renunciation, of loving kindness, of goodwill, thoughts of compassion. So the question for us is really how to put this into practice. Not only here on retreat, but in our lives. How do we practice this teaching? So there's one discourse, you know, in the Buddhist texts, which is called, the name of the discourse is called Two Kinds of Thought. And in it, the Buddha suggests a way for us to begin this practice. So I want to read just a few lines from this particular sutta or discourse. He said, "Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva," that is, bodhisattva is a Buddha to be, "it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, or loving kindness, thoughts of non-cruelty, or compassion." So if we're following in the Bodhisattva's footsteps on this path of awakening, what he is suggesting here is that we be mindful enough of our own minds, of our own thoughts, to discern the difference. So we're actually paying attention, and it's as if we are saying, oh, this is a thought of sensual desire. This is a thought of renunciation. This is a thought of loving kindness. This is a thought of ill will. So we're actually seeing clearly what it is that's going on in our minds. When we notice those thoughts which are wholesome, which are skillful, which are leading to happiness, thoughts of renunciation, of goodwill, of compassion, then we can cultivate those thoughts. We can make them grow. We can strengthen them. And when we notice those thoughts of sensual desire, sensual grasping, when we notice those thoughts of ill will or aversion, or thoughts of cruelty, wanting to harm, when we see them, when we're mindful, then we can practice abandoning them, letting them go. So it's not that we should expect all of these different unwholesome thoughts not to be there. Because if they weren't there, you wouldn't have to be here. But since they are there, we need to be here so that we can learn to see them when they arise. They are going to arise. But mindfulness is that great gift. So we see what's going on. Yes, this should be strengthened. This should be let go of. So all of this is wise reflection in the service of the path, in the service of freedom. So as we do this, we can become increasingly aware of the strength and seductive power of the unwholesome thoughts and intentions. Because one might wonder why, if they're unwholesome and they lead to suffering, why do we keep on having them? Because the habit is deep. And they're very seductive in a certain way. So the Buddha had an interesting comment to make about particularly thoughts of sense desire and thoughts of ill will or hatred. He said, "Ill will and aversion are more dangerous, more harmful than thoughts of sense desire, but they are easier to uproot. And thoughts of sense desire are less dangerous, less harmful, but harder to uproot." So I don't know if you are familiar, you know, in the Buddhist psychology of the three personality types. Maybe you've heard some, you know, that how people are tend predominantly to be either of a kind of greedy nature, you know, sense desire, or of an aversive nature, you know, not liking things so much, or deluded nature. So for those of you who have an aversive nature, you can take some delight in the fact that even though these are quite harmful thoughts, they are actually easier to uproot. Whereas the greedy type, the sense desire type, which is more the type I am, so they're less dangerous, so I take a little happiness in that. But they're harder to uproot, so they're going to be around longer. Why? Because, and it's kind of obvious, thoughts of ill will and aversion and hatred, they're always unpleasant, and the suffering is very obvious. You know, so we see it, and it's easier to see it clearly and to know, yeah, this really contributes to my suffering. Whereas thoughts of desire are often or usually associated with what's pleasant. And so we don't often see the danger in that, the harm in that. Why should I renounce sense desire? It's not always apparent why renunciation is a good idea. You know, and the Buddha himself, you know, as a bodhisattva, he acknowledged that very same tendency. So at one time, there was a group of lay people like us. They were having a discussion with Ananda, you know, who was the Buddha's cousin and close attendant. So this was the discussion the householders were having. They said, "Venerable Ananda, we are householders who indulge in sensuality, delight in sensuality, enjoy sensuality, rejoice in sensuality." So, I mean, it's kind of familiar. You know, we like sense pleasures. For us, indulging in sensuality, delighting in, enjoying, rejoicing, for us, renunciation seems like a sheer drop-off, you know, like falling off the edge of a cliff. Yet I've heard that in this doctrine and discipline, that is the teachings of the Buddha, even the hearts of the very young monks leap up at renunciation, grow confident, steadfast, and firm, seeing it as peace. So right here, this issue of renunciation is where this teaching is contrary to the great mass of people. So this was going on. This is not just us. You know, this is the nature of the human experience. We like what's pleasant. We want what's pleasant. We enjoy what's pleasant. And it's not at all clear why renunciation of this is a good idea. So Ananda, you know, he said, "Well, why don't we go ask the Buddha about this?" You know, because maybe it wasn't clear to him. So Ananda, you know, spoke to the Buddha about this conversation, and this is what the Buddha said. "So it is, Ananda, so it is. Even I myself, before my awakening, while I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, thought, renunciation is good, seclusion is good, but my heart didn't leap up at renunciation, didn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as it is, seeing it as peace." So this is the bodhisattva. This is the Buddha-to-be, who also, before his enlightenment, it wasn't obvious about... Well, it was clear that he understood the value of it, but his heart did not rejoice in it. Right? So maybe we're somewhat similar. So then the Buddha, in the discourse, he goes on to say that by reflecting on the downside, the drawbacks of sense pleasures, and by familiarizing himself with the rewards of renunciation, then there was the possibility of the heart leaping up. at the thought of it. So what the bodhisattva saw that he needed to do was to reflect, okay, well, what are the drawbacks of sense pleasures? And what are the benefits of renunciation? So it needed some familiarization, some reflection. And I think the same is true for us. We need to familiarize ourselves with this because our cultures, our society, we can't say that it really values renunciation. You know, there's one, there are so many examples of this, but just, I was walking down the street in New York and there was a storefront with, you know, selling, I forget now what, but some nice things. And the sign in the window said, "Don't let desire pass you by." You know, that's just one example of countless examples of the message that we keep getting. You know, desire is good. Feed desire. Make desire stronger. So here we have to kind of look with a little more discernment and clarity. So tonight I'd like to emphasize a bit or talk about the drawbacks of sense desires, which is something we don't talk about a lot, and familiarize ourselves a bit with the rewards of renunciation. So the first challenge, the first difficulty we have in thinking about this is the word renunciation itself. Because we often associate renunciation, the word, with a sense of deprivation. You know, that we're depriving ourselves of something. You know, we associate renunciation with a kind of bleak and austere lifestyle. So it's no wonder that our hearts don't leap up at the thought of it. Because deprivation, austerity, bleakness, it's not something in those words, in those associations that really bring us joy. But I found that a more liberating and freeing understanding, a more accurate understanding of renunciation would be the term non-addiction. You know, when we use the term non-addiction, it's easy for us to relate to because I think in one way or another, we all know the potential sufferings of addiction, of the mind that is addicted to something, to whatever it may be. And, you know, there are many, many kinds of addictions. It might be on many levels of intensity. It might be addiction to food, or to sex, or to alcohol, or to drugs. It might be addiction to work, you know, or to power, or to fame. You know, it can be addiction to wealth, you know, to money. It can be addiction to comfort. So it would be interesting just to look at one's life and say, okay, well, where is the mind addicted? You know, where is it holding on to? We can also become addicted to certain mind states, you know, and emotions like excitement or even fear. Now, this is a strange one. One of the things I've often wondered about, and maybe some of you will be able to explain it to me, is the enjoyment some people get from watching horror movies. And the scarier the movie, the better it is. So what it's fear, I think, is the emotion that's being generated, and yet they're very popular. And so, at least for some kinds of minds, there's a kind of addiction to that. I don't know, maybe it's an adrenaline rush. Something's going on. even if it's unpleasant. We can also become addicted not only to the things that we may want, you know, whether it's physical things or mental states, we can become addicted to the wanting itself, where we want to want. So I don't know if the same is true in Europe, but in the States, almost every day in the mail, in the post, is another catalog for something. You know, so, and it's amazing. I mean, it's just almost daily a new catalog selling something. So there's a phenomenon which I've noticed which I call catalog consciousness. Because if you make the mistake of opening it, and I've seen this in myself, keep turning the pages, waiting for something to want. Right? There's nothing in the catalog I want. But I live in hope. Oh, maybe on the next page there'll be something I want. So it's just this addiction to wanting, as if that itself is a certain kind of pleasure. You know, on retreats, and here in the next couple of weeks, you'll have a very good opportunity to observe the addiction we can have. And again, it's on different levels of intensity. Sometimes it's mild, sometimes it's intense. Addiction to different kinds of mind states, different meditative states. You know, maybe we get a taste of calm, and then we just are going for the calm, or rapture. You can also get addicted even to the wisdom side of things. We can get addicted to the investigative mind, you know, where that gets out of balance with trust, with surrender. Very often in our practice, and at different times, we have experiences that we then try to hold on to, or repeat, or have again, to recreate. And I had many different examples of this in my own practice. So I'll mention just a few to give you an idea of the kinds of things where addiction, you know, this wanting, this grasping mind can happen. So early in my years in Bodh Gaya, I was practicing with Munindraji. And I'd been there for some time, I don't know, maybe a year or so, doing quite a lot of practice. And I was doing walking meditation. And just at one point in the walking, it's as if the subject-object duality disappeared. You know, and there was just walking. Right? And there was no one apart from the walking. So I got really excited. Yeah, and I go running to Munindraji, telling him about this great experience and how free I felt. And all he said was, don't recondition your mind. Right? Don't create this particular experience as something that you need to keep having. You know, don't recondition your mind with grasping. Well, of course, it was a big letdown. But it was very wise advice because the practice continued to unfold in many different ways. Another time, this was a couple of years later, I was studying with Goenkaji, who teaches the sweeping, you know, the body scanning method. And after some time, I'd been practicing now for quite a few years, so I was doing this retreat, and at a certain point, it's as if my body just became a body of light. No solidity, it was just light. You know, just flow of light energy. But this is great. I really liked it a lot. You know, and every time I sat, that's what it was like. And then I forget the reason, but I had to leave India. And no, it was visa or money, something. I had to leave. Went back to the States. Couldn't wait to go back to India to my body of light. Well, after a few months in the States and doing whatever I did, went back to India, and it had become a body of twisted steel. You know, and then as I was moving the awareness through the body, it was, you know, trying to force the awareness through it, and all the time, oh, let me get back that body of light. I spent 2 years, 2 years in this struggle. You know, they were the worst 2 years of my practice. It was terrible. Because I was so addicted, so wanting that experience and to recreate it. But something else was happening, and I wasn't opening to what was actually happening. It took 2 years to finally let go of that and just be with the experience as it was. It was like dragging a corpse around for 2 years. And it was dragging around a past experience. So I share this story just so you don't spend 2 years doing something similar. So I mentioned getting attached even to the wisdom side of things. Very interesting, because wisdom is really what we're cultivating. You know, we speak a lot about the development of wisdom. So this is the time when I was practicing in Burma with Sayadaw Upandita. This is many years later. And I had been there, again, for some time, and my mind was getting really concentrated. And I was just seeing the most kind of minute particles of things arising and passing. And it was quite amazing. It was really quite amazing. So I go in and report again, very excited, you know, about what I was seeing. And he just had one comment. He said, "You're too attached to subtlety." It was the perfect response. Because I thought, oh, this is great practice. And what I didn't see was all the wanting that was in the mind. I was just leaning forward, wanting a certain experience. That's not skillful practice. The whole practice is about letting go. And it doesn't matter whether we're letting go of what's subtle or we're letting go of what's not so subtle. It's the letting go that's important. So even subtleties in practice can become very seductive. You know, where we lose sight of really where freedom lies. So what's so seductive and beguiling about our addictions, whether they're really big ones or even small ones, is that in the moment of experiencing they do bring a kind of gratification. They do bring a kind of pleasure. So that's the seduction. You know, when we're experiencing something that's pleasant in one way or another, we are gratified by that. And that's not wrong. That's a natural consequence of experiencing something that's pleasurable. The problem is when we don't look more deeply, we get entranced by that gratification and then keep looking for another and another and another, either to repeat the same one or to find a different source of gratification. So we get caught by that wanting mind, by that grasping mind, until we can be completely enmeshed, completely caught up in this wanting mind, the wanting of sense, some kind of pleasurable sense experience. And very often we don't even know that we're entrapped, because in the ordinary world, people take this to be the normal happiness. Of course we want to experience pleasurable things. And there is an enjoyment, and there is a gratification. But we need to begin to see the drawbacks of this gratification. Because while it's pleasurable in the moment, it is not ultimately satisfying. So if you are of the view that you really don't have major addictions, I suggest you look for the small ones. And being on retreat, there are lots of opportunities to see this tendency of mind. So you might watch during the day just to pay attention to your habitual actions, just to the different habits you've formed while being on retreat. And see how easy it would be, or difficult it would be, to let go of a well-established habit. You know, maybe it's that cup of tea after the 9:15 sitting. You know, you've been up since the early morning, you've done your work period mindfully, hopefully. You know, you come to another sitting. It'd be nice to have a cup of tea and just look at the beautiful mountains. And you just get into the habit, and maybe you're doing it more or less mindfully. But you get into the habit of that. So every day, you know, that's what you do. What would it be like not to do it? I'll share with you one story. So I was on retreat. I was doing a self-retreat. And every morning I was in the habit, I'd get up and make myself a cup of coffee to kind of set up, you know, the day. And I had the coffee beans and the coffee grinder, you know, and I really had this whole ritual of making the cup of coffee. So one morning I get up and the coffee grinder was broken. Didn't work. The first thought that came into my mind, disaster. Now, in the scope of things, a broken coffee grinder is not really a disaster. But that was my first response, because the habit and the attachment to that was so ingrained. The thought of it not happening felt like a disaster, which didn't take me too long to get over, but it was just instructive to see that very initial response. You know, at night, are you in the habit of going to sleep after the last sitting? You know, this is the last sitting, you've been working hard all day, you know, the bell, oh, it's time to go to sleep. Do you go to sleep at that time out of habit or because you're really tired? Maybe sometimes you're not tired at all, you might feel quite awake and you could go on practicing for another half hour, hour, 2 hours. So just see, notice the many things in the day that are habituated. And experiment with the possibility, no, I don't have to follow that habit. I can break the addiction. One of the most interesting aspects or understandings regarding renunciation that we can explore on a retreat is to become aware of these different desires in the mind. And again, they can be big desires, they can be little desires. And be mindful enough so that we see how the desire arises and passes, and that we actually don't have to act on them for them to go away. We get free of the compulsion and the habit of acting on each of our desires. We see their impermanent nature. So even if it's very strong, the desire can arise and we just, oh, desire, desire, desire. It's there for some time and then it goes. There's a great freedom in seeing that. We begin to break that particular habit pattern, to weaken that neural pathway. And one of the things we begin to see and really taste for ourselves, and this is something that I think most people who have not looked at their own minds perhaps are not aware of, is that there is more peace and actually more pleasure in not wanting than in wanting. And so I would suggest, and again, all of this you need to check out for yourselves. You know, all these teachings, it's not something that we are saying and that you're expected to believe. In fact, don't believe any of it. Really just take everything as a suggestion to see for yourself. Is this true? Is it not true? It would be very interesting for you to pay attention next time a desire comes, you know, maybe in a day or two, you know. If you can be mindful at some point in that desire, you know, so you become aware that desire is present, even if it's kind of in the middle or toward the end, and then just really watch what it feels like to be in the grip of wanting. You know, to really be identified with that wanting. And then to notice what it feels like when the desire goes. And it will, because everything is changing and impermanent. Notice what it feels like when the desire is no longer there. So if you're mindful of that transition from wanting to not wanting, I think you will notice that in the non-wanting, there is a much greater sense of ease, of peace, of spaciousness. But most people are not paying this careful attention and so are unaware. And this is familiarizing oneself with the benefit, with the happiness of renunciation, of non-addiction to desire. We're seeing it for ourselves. So the Buddha talked about this. You know, in the Dhammapada, which is a collection of the Buddha's teachings in verses, he said, if by giving up a lesser happiness, which is the happiness of sense desire and sense pleasure, it is a kind of happiness. But he said, if by giving up a lesser happiness, a greater happiness could be found, a wise person would renounce the lesser for the greater. But again, knowing this intellectually is not going to do the trick. Right? We can know it intellectually. We have to actually taste the greater happiness. We have to experience, yes, it's much more peaceful. It's actually a much happier state when we're not wanting than when we're wanting. So check it out. Really pay attention to that. This is a gradual training. You know, we can hear this and even see it many times, but the power, the habit power, the habit pattern of desire and wanting is so strong. So it's not that we see it once or twice and even experience it once or twice and all of our desires are going to disappear. This is something we need to see repeatedly. Because I think for many of us, there's often a deep kind of anxiety or even fear at the thought of giving something up. You know, oh, what will it be like? Or giving up a familiar kind of happiness, you know, when we're not totally sure of what's coming next. So I had a couple of examples of this also in my practice. One, looking back, it's all ridiculous, but at the time, you know, it seemed very compelling. So one time, in my early years in India, in Bodh Gaya, for the first time, I decided to shave my head. And of course, in those years, I still had something to shave. You know, now it would be much less problematic. But then, I was young, I was in my 20s, and it was just, for some reason, the thought of shaving my head and shaving off, it just loomed so large. You know, what's that going to be like? And I'm you know, it was so much a part of my sense of who I was, you know, kind of some image. But I wanted to do it, and so I shaved the head, and it was amazing. Within about 5 seconds of my head being shaved, I realized it didn't make the slightest bit of difference. Not the slightest. It meant nothing in terms of my happiness or giving something up. But before I had given it up, it was huge. Afterwards, it was nothing. That's true of so many of the things, you know, that we're holding on to. Years later, I had practiced most of my early years of practice in India, and then later on, many years later, I started going to Burma. But before I went, I kept hearing all these stories of the austerities of the monastery, you know, and how strict they were, and this was Sada Upandita's monastery. So friends had gone before and was sending back all these stories. So I was a little anxious, even though I'd been practicing for many years. So the night before I was leaving for Burma, I had this anxiety dream. And I dreamt that I went to Burma and I arrived at the monastery and wasn't allowed to sit on a zafu, to sit on a cushion. And in those years, I was still sitting cross-legged. And the thought of not being able to use a cushion was just unthinkable. I didn't know how I was going to be able to do it. So just this anxiety, you know, about, oh, going to Burma, what's it going to be like, you know, came out in the dreams. Of course, it was all fine. And I mean, many times I ended up sitting in a chair in Burma, in the monastery. But the projection of the mind of giving something up, you know, and the fear of that. You know, over time, we might also have very different relationships just to thoughts of coming on retreat. Now, most of you are experienced practitioners, so maybe if you can remember back to the first times you came on retreat, for many people, the thought of silence, you know, they think, this is going to be so hard, you know, can hardly imagine it. And yet it turns out to be what they most enjoy, you know, or the solitude, being alone. Some years ago, I taught a retreat in Italy. It was in a Catholic monastery in the mountains of Tuscany, Camaldoli Monastery. It's 1,000 years old, which itself was amazing. You know, when you think of a place that's been doing spiritual practice for 1,000 years. IMS just celebrated its 40th anniversary, and we thought it was a big thing. So we went up to the monastery, and the monastery had a hermitage a few miles up the road. And the hermitage, in this particular tradition, it had like different monastic cells, each with two very small rooms and a little walled-in garden. And the monks went in for life. They went into these cells for life. This was their commitment. And so they had one that was open, you know, that visitors could see. And so I went into one. And it was so amazing. My reaction so surprised me, because I just went in, and just in the moment anyway, my heart really did leap up at that thought, oh yeah, to be here where one's only companion is awareness. I thought, yeah, it was tremendously inspiring. I thought, of course, I didn't join the order, and it's unlikely that I will. But even that I had the thought, you know, of the potential, it was quite inspiring, you know, to see, oh yes, that silence, that solitude, where our only companion is awareness. You know, what a beautiful thing that could be. So it just gives a flavor, even if that's kind of an extreme case of it, you know, of the power of renunciation. When we give things up, even in a much lesser way than that, it creates a space in our lives. It creates a place of more openness, spaciousness, of peace. You know, and you've all tasted that, and you all know that, you know, just from coming on retreat. You've given up your, you know, all your worldly involvements and engagements and the social interactions. So you all know, you know, the beauty of this. Because it's why you've come. So you might use the time here in one way or another just to play the edge of renunciation. You know, because I know from my own practice, it's very easy, even within a situation of a retreat where there is already significant renunciation of our worldly life, still it's very easy to get into our own particular comfort zone of how we do a retreat. You know, of how much we sit, of how much we walk, of how much we eat, just lots of different things. So it might be an interesting challenge just to explore the edges of your comfort zone and see, okay, at that edge, is there something that I could give up, I could renounce for this period of time or even for a few days of the retreat? Oh, just as a couple of examples. You know, very commonly in Asia, and this is the norm, when you go to a monastery to practice, everyone is on 8 precepts, not 5 precepts. And the following, the last three, probably the most challenging one, might be not eating after the noon meal. Not taking anything solid after the noon meal. You know, so only like juice or water. And then that's the sixth. The seventh is not adorning the body, you know, beautifying it with jewelry or adornments or, you know, things we do to make the body beautiful, and also avoiding singing and dancing shows. Well, I don't think any of the four of us are going to be singing and dancing, so that part should be easy. And then not to be sleeping on high and luxurious beds, so that's not a problem either. But you might experiment, you know, if you're inspired, maybe to take the 8 precepts, you know, for a day, for 2 days, for the whole retreat, and see what that's like. You could experiment with sleep. You know, maybe give yourself a few days to really settle into the retreat. But if you're used to sleeping 7 hours or 8 hours, see what it's like to sleep 6 hours. Maybe even 5 hours. You can play. This is not a commandment. So you want to do it with the sense of joy or of interest or investigation. Oh, let me see what this is like. Is it helpful? Is it not helpful? You know, so you really know for yourself. And you could find your own ways, you know, just pushing the edge of the comfort zone a little bit. Probably one of the most powerful and skillful habit patterns that we can look at is the habit patterns we've established in how we pay attention. You know, because we've all gotten into a kind of groove of how we're practicing mindfulness and the quality of our attention. And I talked about it a little bit this morning when, you know, I was suggesting to look at the difference between being relaxed and being casual. That has to do with the quality of attention. So just as an example of just how immediate the effect can be of paying really careful attention, one time I was practicing with Sayadaw Upandita in Nepal. And the conditions were terrible. There were 5 of us sleeping in a room on a cement floor right next to the latrine, so the smells were terrible. The food was really terrible. Everything, just hard conditions. And so my mind was very grumpy. you know, and just inwardly I was complaining a lot of complaining mind inside. So I go into Sayadaw and I report on what's happening in my mind. And he just had three words of advice. He said, be more mindful. And I thought, thanks a lot. There was no acknowledgement at all of the difficulties and the conditions and certainly no sympathy. You know, just be more mindful. So after I got over my initial reaction to his comment, I went outside and I was doing walking. Well, this is this great meditation master. Why don't I try following his advice? So I started walking more mindfully, of really feeling the details, just as we did this morning when we did the walking instruction in the room, just really feeling the details and nuances of sensations in each step. Within a few steps, all of that complaining, grumpy mind had disappeared because there was no room for it. The mind was so connected to the present moment experience that there was no room for the unskillful patterns to arise. And it's not that they never did again. Of course, when I lost that level of mindfulness, they came back. But I saw the way, you know, that we can change and train our habit of attention, of how we're paying attention. One of the beautiful things of practicing in Burma at the monasteries particularly was watching the Burmese women meditators. The men were men were a little sloppy. But the watching the women, just as they moved through the day, it was so beautiful because they were so, most, not obviously not everyone, but many, just so mindful and graceful in every movement they made. Just watching them helped my own mind become more concentrated and calm because it showed, oh yeah, it's possible to actually practice in this way. It's not hard to do. It's hard to remember to do. You know, it's not hard to pay attention, to feel carefully what we're doing. But we forget. And so this is a reminder, you know, that we can renounce our habitual way of paying attention if it's a little sloppy or intermittent. We can renounce that level of mindfulness for a greater level of mindfulness where we're really dropped into our body. And again, as I said this morning, it's not straining to be mindful. It's simply being in the body, feeling what we're doing. It's like a slow classical dance or yoga or tai chi. When we're fully embodied and present, we can practice that throughout the whole day. You know, where we're practicing having the day be seamless. It's not the meditation is sitting and then you get up and you leave and, okay, then I'll do walking meditation. And then you finish with that and you get busy with something. And then, no, it's the whole day. Everything is equal. So retreat is a fantastic time to practice this because there's nothing else you have to do. This is your only job. You're not getting paid much for it, but it's your only job. You're getting paid inwardly. So we can practice renouncing, you know, the more casual way of paying attention and pay attention in a more careful way, feeling it. We can also renounce just a lot of the complexity, you know, in our minds. We can and do very often create very complicated stories about our lives. You know, we, most of us have all these, or at different times, have these big dramas going on, and we get caught up in a lot of proliferating thoughts about it. And we're just caught up in this complexity of our lives. And so we make our lives very complicated. One of the interesting things to learn in meditation, and this is really a profound learning and insight, is that even though we think our lives are busy and complicated and complex and all these things are going on, when you look carefully, only six things are ever happening. Your whole life, our whole life, it's just a succession of six things. It's either a sight, or a sound, or a smell, or a taste, or a sensation, or some mind object, a thought or emotion. Who experiences anything else? The Buddha challenged, he gave this discourse which he called the all. And he said, this is the all of experience. And he challenged people to express anything other than that. The problem is we create concepts for what's seen and heard and smelled and tasted, you know. So we, and not seeing those concepts simply are thoughts in the mind, and so we get lost in this world of concepts of drama, and we're inhabiting that world. It might be interesting just at some time, just again as an experiment, just to start noticing all of your experience in terms of those six things. And usually there's not much taste, except when we're eating. You know, and sometimes smell, scent is predominant, but sometimes not. So it might even come down to just four things. And just to note, you know, just spend even 10 minutes or half an hour or, you know, an hour, just noting how the sequence of experience is just one of these four things. Our life is really, going back to the six senses, it's really like a six-piece chamber orchestra. And our life is the music this chamber orchestra is playing. And sometimes it's skilled musicians, and sometimes it's not so skilled musicians. You know where we get caught up. Where we get caught up a lot, as I mentioned, is in the world of our thoughts, our concepts. You know, we believe the stories. So Munindraji had a great teaching about this. If you could apply this one teaching, your life would become immeasurably simpler. Get ready? A very simple teaching, but the thought of your mother is not your mother. It's a thought. You can substitute anything for mother. The thought of something is not the thing itself. It's a thought. When we're lost in the concept, we create whole inner worlds that we're living in and reacting to, and life is very complicated. When we see, this is just a thought in the mind. A thought is really light. If we're not buying into the concept, the thought comes and goes. There's a lot we can and will be saying about this. And it's not to suggest that we never use the conceptual level. Obviously we do, and many aspects of our lives, it's an essential part of it. But for most of the thoughts we have, they're useless. And I think it's worth recognizing that. So renouncing, you know, to some degree, the habit of different kinds of sensual pleasure habits, know, the wanting mind, and seeing that there's actually greater peace in not wanting. Renouncing for some time, you know, the complexity of the mind, and seeing that it's just these few things happening again and again. Renouncing at that place of the comfort zone in our practice. Renouncing our habitual way of paying attention. And see if we can drop in, at least for periods of time, to a more careful kind of attention. Renouncing the intermittent nature of mindfulness. And so we're actually practicing as best we can the continuous nature, that this is actually possible. The mantra can be each step. Each step is equally important. Each movement is equally important. The last kind of renunciation I want to mention, I call it the wisdom of no. Because so often in our spiritual practice and teaching, there's a huge emphasis on the yes of things, where we're saying yes to what's there, where we're open to what's there, where we're accepting of what's there. And of course, this is hugely important. This is the major part of our practice, settling back, opening to, being receptive, yes to this experience, yes to this experience. And this yes is an antidote to aversion, it's an antidote to self-judgment. You know, so we need to learn how to open and say yes to experience. But there's also a wisdom of no. Recognizing that some things are not skillful, are not helpful, are not leading to our happiness or well-being. And we can practice in our minds saying, when these things arise, no thanks. I'll pass on this one. This desire is not so helpful. This wanting is not so helpful. I can let it go. It's important to understand what this wise restraint means, because people often misinterpret it. This restraint, this wisdom of no, is not about judgment. It's not about aversion to what's happening. It's not about denial of what's there. It's not about suppression of what's there. Rather, it's just clear seeing what's arising in the mind at different moments, seeing, oh, this is harmful, this is not helpful, I can let this go. You know, each one of us and I'm sure you're familiar with this part of your mind. Each one of us really has an inner two-year-old. So just imagine if you had an actual two-year-old and you said yes to everything. It would grow up to be a monster. You know, because often the two-year-old will be doing things that are not good for it, that are going to harm it. And so we need to be able to say no in a loving, kind way. We're saying no out of caring. We're saying no out of compassion, not out of aversion or ill will. We need to learn how to apply that to parts of our own mind, parts of our own experience. This can become a very powerful tool of practice. The loving no. I'll let this go. I want to read one poem, which is a great poem about the value, the benefit of being able to say no. And this is by the Palestinian-American poet Naomi Shihab Nye. And she's a wonderful poet. And the name of this poem is The Art of Disappearing. So she's talking about social interactions. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what potters are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem, greasy sausage balls on a paper plate, then reply. If they say we should get together, say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees. The monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf, knowing you could tumble at any time. Then decide what to do with your time. You know, and so I love it because it just makes us think about our habit patterns, you know, and of what's really helpful and what's really important in our lives. And obviously, it doesn't mean that we all join that 1,000-year-old monastery. We do interact. We have social engagements. But are we taking the time, as you are doing here, to remember what's important and to carry that into your life outside? You know, here the power of no really becomes the expression of a free mind. It's a conservation of energy. It's a steadfastness and a stillness. So there's a book by Joseph Campbell called Hero with a Thousand Faces. And he tells the story in mythological terms, the life story of the Buddha. And he's describing that scene, the night of his enlightenment, sitting under the Bodhi tree, not yet enlightened, still a bodhisattva, when all the forces of Mara, of greed and aversion and desire and lust and ignorance, of all these forces of Mara appeared to the bodhisattva's mind. And Joseph Campbell, he describes the mind of the bodhisattva with one line that has always tremendously inspired my practice as a potential. So he's describing all these forces appearing to the bodhisattva, and he says, "And the mind of the great being was not moved." You know, and for me, just the power of that, you know, to be developing a mind that can be with everything, that can see everything, that can be experience everything, and yet not moved by wanting or grasping or aversion. The freedom of that and the peace of that. And that's what we're able to practice here. You know, and even if it's just for short moments at a time, to recognize those moments. You know, because they really give us a taste of the potential in our lives. You know, a taste of the freedom that's possible.